Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I'm going to do a long lean here to grab our first story, and this one is about a new kind of medical tourism. And actually, I'd have to tell you, I heard about this in Le Monde, the French newspaper that means the world, and I was reading a very long article that they wrote about a festival that homeless people who are living out of their RVs and trailers and trucks have in Quartzsite, Arizona every year. And it's kind of a Burning Man. It's a place where if you are newly homeless, you can go and learn the tricks of the trade, the rules of the road, and strategies. Also, it's right across the border from Mexico, and a segment of the article was talking about this reverse migration, if you will. All of the cities along the Mexican border at the border crossings have very, very large medical streets, places where there might be 4 or 5 or 10 dentists' office on a single couple of blocks. All of these strategies are there to make money because there is a huge number of people who move down, who go down to Mexico to purchase healthcare services. And the French were musing about this, of course, because they have a lovely national health program. And they seem to manage to still have private insurance without profiteering, which seems like a complete oxymoron in my view, but that's just my opinion. It's super interesting, though, to see how many people are going down to Mexico, and a lot of them are heading for pharmacies. Last October, a story broke in the Salt Lake City Tribune. The health plan for Utah State employees and family members began offering its beneficiaries free travel packages to Mexico so that they could buy the high-priced meds down there. So they get free round-trip air tickets from Utah to San Diego, ground travel across the border to Tijuana, and they have a priority lane, and a $500 cash award for their troubles and probably put themselves up. Maybe they want to head for the beach after they've bought their drugs. And they're brought to a clinic by the PHEP. This is the health plan. It's validated clinic that they say is just as good as the Cleveland Clinic or a Mayo Clinic. You can get a really significant discount on drugs, things like all of these biologicals, stuff for MS. A month's supply of Avonex costs $6,700 in the U.S. This is a drug for multiple sclerosis. It's $2,000 for a month's supply. It's still a lot of money. So if you take a look at the costs, the plan is the health plan is saving about $13,000 per patient every 3 months if they send them down to Mexico to buy the drugs. And legally, you are allowed to bring back up to 50 doses of a medication into the U.S. without a United States prescription, excluding narcotics and cannabis, of course. But you can also buy a 90-day supply if you've got a valid prescription in your own name. So lots and lots of people are doing that. One of the problems, drug counterfeiting is a bit of an issue. So we have to be concerned that maybe that Avonex isn't really Avonex. But in the case of things that are like expensive medications where you can tell if they're working, it seems to me a pretty reasonable strategy, and I'm just sorry we have to employ it. So I wanted to talk about a new probiotic that's about to be marketed. It's Ritter Pharmaceuticals makes it, and I don't know what its catchy title is going to be, but it's not really a probiotic, but it's aimed at promoting relief of lactose intolerance. Now, there's 40 million people out there in the United States alone who experience digestive discomfort after consuming lactose-containing foods. Sometimes they can get away okay with yogurt, but many people are not able to consume dairy. And you know, that really is, in our culture, a substantial impediment to the potluck experience, let's say. Probiotics sometimes help, but it's variable. Really depends upon which probiotic you take, and no one's really figured out best practices. You can buy over-the-counter enzymes. But what this company is trying to do is my favorite thing. They're doing gut gardening. So they have found a fiber, a galacto-oligosaccharide, that specifically encourages bifidobacterium, very notably, significantly, about 78% increase if you take this fiber. And this is helpful for increasing the bacteria that help you digest lactose by making their own lactase enzyme and leaving it lying around in your small intestine for any lactose to be, lassoed and beat into submission. As a result, you too can absorb the lactose, and it's not going to give as much gas or diarrhea. So pretty nice strategy. As with all prebiotics, these are basically starches. Apple pectin is a very good general prebiotic and one of the cheapest. Root vegetables often have prebiotic type starch in them, and my advice is a different root vegetable every day. Try to rotate them. Maybe one day it's beets, the next day grated carrots in your salad, the next day maybe a small purple potato, perhaps the day after that some sliced turnips. Actually, if you slice them thin, they're really quite good added to soups or other mixed vegetable dishes. So something that I have recently discovered, turnips and rutabagas, which were definitely not part of my childhood diet. We're going now to our first email. This from Rebecca, who locates herself in California. What is the most economical way to know if I would need to take methylated B vitamins, folate, and or B12, and at what dose? Would you recommend genetic testing or following homocysteine levels? Is there an online service, or does this have to be ordered by a healthcare provider? I'd very much appreciate your input prior to spending on supplements or risking brain health. Thank you. Well, thank you, Rebecca, for an excellent question. For those of you who don't know what Rebecca's asking about, MTHFR stands for methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. And this is a enzyme, as many genes code for proteins. In fact, all of them code, all genes that code for proteins. Turns out that this particular protein, it acts like a little factory thing. Like you might have a factory floor with a bunch of little robots doing, let's screw on put a nut and a bolt on here and then send it down to the next machine. Well, that's what enzymes do. And in the case of MTHFR, it takes methylfolate and it reduces it. That means it takes off a hydrogen and usually means it inserts a double bond somewhere. So this is important for the structure of molecules. A double bond is very rigid, so the molecule won't spin. If you have a double bond, it won't spin at that location. So you can see how mechanical this all is. In the most common folate mutation in the 07 or 8 enzyme folic acid conversion pathway is MTHFR. So maybe 3%, 2 to 3% of the population will have one mutation there. About 10% will have one mutation. About 3% will have two mutations. We call that being homozygous. And it's worse if you have two mutations, because then nobody is able to take up the slack and you have trouble processing folic acid. This can lead to, among other things, increased risk of cancer, heart disease, and mental illness, because folic acid is critical, or rather this pathway is critical, to making SAMe, which is the methyl donor that helps your body make neurotransmitters. So no neurotransmitters, low production of them, neurotransmitters get out of balance and you have mental illness like bipolar, anxiety, and depression, all more common in people with this MTHFR mutation. homocysteine levels that Rebecca mentions are important, but the problem with them is that just because you have a normal homocysteine doesn't mean that you've got the right version of the enzymes. Sometimes there are bypass pathways. An elevated homocysteine, my friends, is not good to have in your bloodstream because it's procoagulant. That makes your blood more likely to clot, never good for heart attack and stroke. And it's also something that is actually kind of an irritant to the arterial wall, so it's inflammatory. And we'll be coming to another email down the line about inflammation being the pivotal thing, not cholesterol really, but inflammation is the pivotal thing for heart disease. So keeping that inflammation low is key for all of us, but particularly key for people with cholesterol issues. Getting back to Rebecca, I did some research on MTHFR testing, and it's expensive. Quest Labs had it at $236 for their cash price. Another lab that I found had it at $394. This is not looking like a good price to me. 23andMe tests all of your genes, including the genes in question for MTHFR, but it doesn't actually tell you in its material whether you have this mutation or not. So you can get your 23andMe raw data and then use that through a number of internet services. The one I'm going to tell you about is the Genetic Genie Methylation Profile. Please give these folks $5 or $10 because this is out there as a web-based utility and there are no ads on the site. So it's a gift to humanity. Spot them a fiver. But you can take your 23andMe, upload it to this website, and you will get back a reading of not just your MTHFR, but a lot of other bits of DNA that are related to the B12 pathway and the formation, the process where you trace something called the transsulfuration pathway, where you play around with fun and games with playing around with sulfur and cysteine. And by the way, homocysteine, that's coming off that pathway or not, depending on how well your MTHFR is working and what else is working or not working in this very, very complex pathway. There are people online who will take you deeply into the weeds on this, and I'm not one of them. I sort of scurry about the edges of this weed field, and I know enough to help me with most of my patients to keep them safe, and that's my goal. Our next email comes from Billy, and it's regarding fibromyalgia. My daughter-in-law has done wonders with diet in healing her fibromyalgia pain, but it seems to have returned. What's your philosophy on the subject? Well, okay, my philosophy, Billy, is that fibromyalgia is a syndrome, not an entity. So there are a number of ways to get there. And it's defined as musculoskeletal pain with very tight little knots in your muscles. And there are 15 sites. You have to have like 11 of the 15 sites being super tender in order to qualify it for the medical diagnosis. The reason for the qualification being so rigid, first of all, it's rheumatologists writing this and they're very protocol oriented, but also because you can, in fact, get disability from fibromyalgia, and there's no test for it. So they really don't want people malingering. In a very interesting study done easily 25 years ago, healthy college students were subjected to sleep deprivation. They were in a sleep lab. Whenever they started to get into deep sleep, that is stage 4 sleep, they were awakened by a buzzer. And after 3 days of plenty of REM sleep, but no stage 4 deep sleep, all of them were beginning to exhibit signs of brain fog and, you guessed it, fibromyalgia. So if the experimental model in humans for fibromyalgia is sleep deprivation, this helps explain why many people develop fibromyalgia after surgery or after a broken limb or some other painful thing that is a localized pain, and then they move to generalized pain. In a brain scan, the pain-sensing areas of the brain appear to be sleep upregulated, so they're hypersensitized. This is a software error. A new loop has been created spontaneously, and now things don't settle down the way they used to. So you get an exaggerated sensory response, which of course impairs sleep, which of course makes the whole thing worse. So my philosophy, and diet, I think, can work in a number of ways. Eliminating food sensitivities, eliminating inflammation, these are both key ways that fibromyalgia is helped by diet. But I want people to be sleeping. So this is a case where I will often use a pharmaceutical. I like to start with low doses of old-fashioned tricyclic inhibitors. A good example of that would be Elavil. And when I say low doses, I'm talking about, a 30th of the treatment dose for depression. But at that dose, this stimulates deep sleep. And I found that within a week or two of these low doses, the individuals are often feeling much better. A second thing that's very important, probably because it helps sleep, is gradually increasing exercise. And this is also helpful in chronic fatigue. We're going to take a pause right now in the emails and go to our first caller. Bill, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks. Yes, I've been diagnosed and I've had imaging done, MRI and X-ray of my left knee, and the verdict is partial tear ACL. I was told at the time that there's not really any treatment. So I'm just wanting another opinion. The inconvenience for me is that I'm not able to hike or descend stairs very comfortably.
Okay.
There's quite a bit of movement in the joint. And I've done PT, and that generally helps with the mechanics of my movement in general pretty well, but it doesn't do anything for the amount of movement in the joint so far.
Okay, so you've got some instability because the tendon's partially torn, and so you can imagine how, like, if a rope is partially cut, it might unwind a little bit. And even though tendons aren't really in a spiral, you could get, you know, more movement. And I'm sure that's exactly how this is going for you. You said you did physical therapy. How many sessions of physical therapy did you do for this when they sent you?
I think 16.
All right. And have you continued with the exercises? Because that's really key with this.
Yes, I did. At this point, there's more I could do. I have faltered a bit by now, I've not made any change in the amount of looseness in the joint. The discomfort is better in general with PT.
Right. Well, it can improve the instability of the joint. So I would encourage you to, now that you went to 16 sessions, so you've got your technique down, and working at a gym where you are working the hamstrings and the quads in particular, so leg extensions and the one where you're usually you're sitting or lying on your belly and bending your knee, that works the hamstrings. And you really want to overdevelop these muscles relative to the rest of your muscle development. But I would do it on both sides because you want symmetry as well. How long ago was your injury?
2 years.
Okay. So you probably have gotten all of the spontaneous contraction that you're going to get. And when they said partial tear, did they tell you that it was likely to, did they give you any cautions, like no skiing, things like that, no roller skating?
No.
All right. So I would tell you that unless you are a really excellent skier, and in which case you would probably have complained about that, you probably shouldn't do skiing because we tend to fall backwards, puts pressure on the ACL, and you might blow out the rest of it. And the surgery is not as good as even a stretched out ACL tendon in terms for a lot of reasons. So I would discourage trying to deliberately tear the tendon in order to be able to get the surgery. But I would encourage cautious weight lifting with very slow movements, very slow up and slow down, because you really want to shorten the muscles. And a shorter muscle is going to stabilize that knee. So you may be able to improve things by going back to the gym and using fairly high weights. Work up to that, of course, and maybe use one of the trainers at the gym to spot you so that you're using proper technique. It's super important that the angle, that the knee is in the right place on the machine. And you, so you need to figure out what your adjustment numbers are.
Right. Okay. That's what I wanted to hear. Yeah. Well, it's also what I didn't want to hear, but...
Well, acupuncture is good for pain, but I don't typically find that it helps. I don't believe that it alters the structure. There is there are some therapies that do shorten tendons, like prolotherapy, but I don't think there's anybody. This is putting sugar water into a tendon, causes it to scar up a little bit and shorten, but I don't think anyone's going into the knee with sugar water to do that. It'd be too hard to hit the tendon.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. All right, so let's go to an email, then a story. This one from Mark in Delray Beach, Florida. Mark writes, I'm 5'6" and 142 pounds. I lost 11 pounds over the last 3 months on a paleo diet. I take vitamin D, fish oil, and magnesium every day. I had blood work last month showing my cholesterol is 226, HDL is 47. So that's basically giving him a ratio of about 5, not great, but not horrible. Triglyceride level is 91. That's good. For breakfast, I eat one fried egg with spinach. I read that eggs increase my chance of heart disease. This contradicts the article from the Mayo Clinic. I thought liver produced less cholesterol if you get more from your diet. What do you think? What should I be eating for breakfast? Okay, so he's referencing an article that was on CNN, and this was relating to another article that showed up in, I believe, the Journal of the American Medical Association. So I'm not going to be able to pull that article up. And so I'll tell you what I remember about it was that it was a meta-analysis, and it was drawn from about 14,000 pooled studies. There were 6 pooled studies. Is important to start by saying, my friend Mark, this is a meta-analysis, and you can never draw conclusions from a meta-analysis. Whenever you read something where they've taken multiple other studies and pooled the results, the problem with that is that you cannot be sure that the results that you that the papers that you chose did not themselves contain a bias. And so when you pool studies, you get very small and clinically meaningless effects showing up as statistically significant. And in the study in question, there was something like a 0.5% increased risk of heart disease, or 1% for every 0.5 egg per day consumed. And it's like, okay, when you see stuff like that, that's the fallacy of large numbers. And people want to get published, so they'll put together a dozen studies, or in this case, 6 large studies, to get numbers in the 5 figures. Because basically, when you have numbers in the 5 figures, things will show up as statistically significant, which are really not meaningful clinically and do not really apply to any given individual any more than if you always use the same lottery number, you're going to win the lottery someday because each lottery because that number is going to come up sooner or later. This is a logical fallacy. I think what's most important when a person is looking at their cholesterol is how much oxidized LDL do you have? And I'm really happy to announce that my local lab, which is Quest Diagnostics, that I use most of the time because they've got drawing stations all over the place, has now merged with Cleveland Heart Labs. So you can get an oxidized LDL, which is really wonderful because that will tell you what your whether or not your cholesterol is inflamed. And if it's oxidized and your blood vessel walls are inflamed because you smoke or you have heart disease, so there's an injury there. So injury plus oxidized LDL is going to be like my dog's hair on black polar fleece. It's going to be all over it, and you're never going to get it out. So check your oxidized LDL. If it's high, you probably need to be eating lots more fruits and vegetables. And in this particular case with Mark, he's got a triglyceride of 91. So that means his insulin levels are probably fairly low. And I'm not worried about Mark having heart disease on the basis of being pre-diabetic or having metabolic syndrome. Does the liver produce less cholesterol if you get more from your diet? Depends on how much you're burning. The liver produces cholesterol all the time. It's the basis for, among other things, estrogen, cortisol, aldosterone. These are all steroid hormones, and your body manufactures the cholesterol. The cholesterol you eat actually generally gets broken down in your intestine and may eventually turn back into cholesterol, but more likely it will be burnt as food if you are eating less than you burn. And that's a super important thing. Get more exercise, and among other things, your cholesterol drops, and your oxidized cholesterol drops a lot. So why I'm talking about this is I've gotten a lot of questions also about TMAO. And this is a compound called trimethylene N-oxide. If you eat amino acids, if you eat protein, if you eat eggs, betaine, carnitine, these other amino acids often used as supplements, you will take a compound called trimethylamine, which is present in all amino acids, and you'll convert it into this N-oxidized version. And in about 2013, there was a correlation between elevated plasma levels of TMAO and an increased risk for cardiovascular disease and stroke. So this is also a bit of a logical fallacy, because this is correlation. Correlation doesn't mean causation. There have been a lot of subsequent studies, and the TMAO is basically a microbiome issue, like many things. If the gut bacterial composition in the gut is healthy and balanced, you don't get high levels of TMAO, because those bacteria are not present in high levels, so they don't do that processing. Remember what I said earlier about encouraging probiotics that would process lactose by giving them another thing that they like to eat? Well, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. So there is really no evidence that elevated TMAO results in any other elevation that might be expected to be a cardiac risk factor. So what we have is an association. And I will also point out that fish and seafood are also rich in TMA, but they're not implicated in increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So one other thing that is interesting is that your broccoli and your kale and your other cruciferous vegetables actually inhibit an enzyme that converts TMA, but that's probably not the reason that your vegetables are good for you. So should you worry? I don't think so. Eat your eggs. Do get your cholesterol checked periodically. If it's elevated, you do need to shift your diet, but I'd be shifting I usually shift the diet away from flour and sugar first before I take away eggs, which are an excellent source of protein, and also choline, which is super important for brain function. And if I had to choose between brain and heart, I'm sorry, I guess I'll pick my brain. Our next email is from Ari in Santa Cruz. And we're on a thread here, folks. MTHR mutation and methotrexate. Hi, Dr. Don. I just started on low-dose methotrexate for lupus. The prescribing doctor advised me to take folic acid along with the methotrexate. I'd previously been tested for the MTHFR mutation, so I asked her if the L-methylfolate I'd been taking would work. She didn't know and told me to ask the doctor who tested for the mutation. That doctor didn't know either. In my follow-up appointment with the rheumatologist, she said she'd look for related studies and can't find many. I did my own internet search trying to focus on medical study abstracts and didn't find much. I did find, however, a prescription L-methylfolate marketed towards rheumatologists. Can you advise me? Well, I think so, Ari. Methotrexate is actually a chemotherapy drug that's been repurposed as a general anti-inflammatory for rheumatologic diseases. And when it's used in chemotherapy doses, it's fairly toxic, especially to the intestines. It acts by inhibiting an enzyme called dihydrofolate reductase. And of course, you have a mutation in methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. So you're in that same enzyme pathway, and it's already slowed down, and it's a pathway you need. So taking the methylfolate should replace taking the folate and work just as well. As far as there being no studies, for one thing, I think the methylfolate story is still fairly unknown in general medicine. I would be very surprised if the average rheumatologist knew anything about it, because it's mainly been the cardiologists who have talked about it and studied it at all. And I want to emphasize, it actually has much broader applications, and there are epidemiologic studies showing this, but it just hasn't penetrated the consciousness down to the primary care level for most people. It is going to be active in the gut and the mouth. Primarily what we see is fewer mouth ulcers and fewer gut problems, which is a problem with even low-dose methotrexate. So I would say stick with your methylfolate. You probably want to kick the dose up to perhaps 1,600 micrograms. Typically, they'll use about 2 grams of folic acid for this indication. But I would never use folic acid at that level in a person who had this mutation, because I might end up causing them to have a lot of circulating folic acid. And you really don't want that. You want your folic acid to be sucked up by the cells and utilized. And if it can't be utilized, it'll back up in the bloodstream. And that actually can, or has been statistically, associated with an increased event rate for heart disease in individuals who already have heart disease. So it's not something that shows up in the general population. The risk there is probably vanishingly small, if it exists at all. But I just don't like to do things that have any risk if I can avoid it. So stick with your methylfolate. And again, if after listening to this, anyone out there is interested in getting a how-to, please, you can email me, and I will give you the basics of how you can figure this out relatively cheaply on yourself and your family. Why would you want to? Well, what about family history of cleft palate, family history of any kind of frequent miscarriage? That would be one that would definitely make me want to check the folic acid pathway in that individual. And if anyone knows of a cheaper way than the one I've outlined, please tell me. And I don't get any advertising dollars from 23andMe, and I don't accept advertising from anybody anyway, for the reason that I don't want to even subconsciously feel unduly influenced. And I think it's very easy for that to happen. I'm going to talk about glyphosate testing. That's Roundup. So U.S. Justice recognizes the role of Monsanto's Roundup weed killer in cancer. This was a unanimous decision in a lawsuit filed in a California court. And here's basically the two-parter is that a federal jury, yesterday, ruled that Roundup was a substantial factor triggering cancer in the case of a 70-year-old man who regularly used Roundup in his property and developed an unusual cancer called non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, B-cell dominant, and this is one that has been, on statistics, associated with Roundup, and it's there's about 700 other cases floating around there. So what makes this important is the jury looked at all the data and ruled that there is reason to believe that the Roundup contributed to this gentleman's cancer. And so what that does is it opens up the discovery of the second phase of this trial, which is to look at all of the memos and research and secret communications that Monsanto has had to deliver to the court to see whether they knew it was a problem and hid it. And the stuff that's going on with Purdue Pharma now, and if you're following that story, that's the OxyContin company, shows that when you can get a hold of the internal memos and the internal science, you make that case much bigger. Look for lots and lots of Roundup lawsuits coming down the pike. And by now, you're probably wondering if you've got Roundup in your water supply or whether you might have a Roundup problem yourself. Well, there have been urine and blood tests for Roundup, and a glyphosate home test in food and water has just been released. The company is Abraxis. I'll spell that Abraxis. And it is a commercial dip and strip test for detecting it. It's very sensitive, uses the same parts per billion technology that the home pregnancy test uses. And you can order your kits at the Detox Project website. You can get 2 test or 5 test packages. Looks like a good thing. I'm going to buy it and test my water since I'm on a well. If you get the blood test, it will only show your exposure for the last 2 or 3 days. However, if you're continuing to use Roundup and you sprayed it, let's say, on the garden on Saturday, getting tested Monday morning would tell you whether or not whether you absorbed any, and that might be a prudent thing to do if you're a gardener or a greens person at a golf course or anywhere where you might be using this stuff. You could sort of spot check your protective gear. Urine tests are good for the last 2 to 3 weeks, but they don't tell you about whether you had previous risks or if you got sprayed somehow. Maybe the neighbor was spraying their and there was a wind, and you tasted something funny, and you're worried. So hair testing, that'll tell you in the last 90 to 120 days, and that is also available through that Detox Project website. So my suggestion is that you might want to look into that if you're worried. Not trying to make you scared about Roundup. I think there's plenty to be concerned about, but I also think that most cancers are multifactorial, and that the people who are using this professionally and subjected to very high doses are the ones that are really at risk and need to think about this kind of testing. Interesting things from a magazine called Practical Pain Management, which is one of the free magazines I get. I'm technically a pain specialist because of my acupuncture practice, and I find that this has a lot of very interesting articles, and I also find pain doctors to be some of the most compassionate and resourceful physicians out there, and among the most open-minded, which is really nice. So we're going to take a moment and talk about monoclonal antibodies for chronic migraine, because there is this new drug that's starting to get advertised, and it is a drug that goes after calcitonin gene-related peptide. The name of it is ianalumab. And if you ever see MAB in the ending of a word, you want to be worried about that. If the generic name of a drug ends in MAB, that means it's a monoclonal antibody. And these are relatively new and have interesting and exotic side effects and should not be used trivially. In the case of this particular one, this is, I think, going to be a disaster. And I have great concerns over the use of these calcitonin gene-related peptides to treat migraines. You'd have to have, in my opinion, your back against the wall to want to do that. looking at the effectiveness of this drug, the actual reduction in symptoms is not great. In one study, the study published in this magazine, there were 220 patients. 94 of them had 0 to 30% relief. That's 43%. 24% had 70 to 100% relief. And this is reducing the frequency of migraines. Lots of potential downsides with this because CGRP is everywhere. It's not just in the brain. It is an inhibitor of platelet aggregation. So blocking this might increase the risk of stroke and heart attack. That's not known. It may make hypertension worse. It may impair healing. It might interfere with hormonal effects because CGRP is important in the pituitary and the hypothalamus, which are the master directors of our hormones. Some people have had really bad fatigue with it. It's involved with bone healing. In the GI tract, it does it dozens of things, including motility and protection. They've seen constipation or diarrhea with the drug, and it was released about a year ago. So far, there have been 7,000 adverse effects, 800 of those serious, and multiple hospitalizations. So this is not a drug to consider using anytime soon. If you have severe migraines and would like to discuss what you might do for them, please give me a call before you let your doctor give you this drug. It is not right for you, as we say in the ads. We're going now to Liz in Indiana. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. I'm so glad you're a weekly show again.
Me too.
Hey. Now I'm just waiting for downloads because I'm in a different time zone and it's kind of hard to keep up. On that roundup, thank you for that information because they spray it on the fields around here in the fall. So that's good to know you can get tested for that.
Right.
My question is about, I have some CT scans coming up. And I had been told before that I was allergic to the contrast. I once was sneezing, I think, and they didn't tell me anything. And the next time it was hiccups, and the gal finally told me, and she wrote down the OmniPack 350 and said I was allergic to it and I needed to tell doctors about it. So I've tried to avoid the contrast.
Mm-hmm, good.
Different texts tell me different things. And I'm scheduled for some next week. And they want to do the barium, and I just wanted to know what your opinion on the contrasts were and if I should avoid the barium, too, or if it's the, from what I think it's the iodine.
Yes.
In the OmniPack.
Right. It is.
But so, I didn't remember getting an injection, so that was why I was confused.
So that is confusing. In general, people are allergic to the intravenous contrast, and they have a reaction to iodine. We're always really worried if someone tells us that they have a shellfish allergy, that they might cross-react with iodine. So we'll usually have like some epinephrine and some steroids ready in a syringe to inject to the person if they grab their throat immediately after the contrast. And then we never give it to them again. We can also see people having problems with contrast in the kidneys, and so it's important that you have good kidney function. May I ask, Liz, so they're going to give you barium, I guess, orally and possibly rectally, is that for this next test, is that right?
Just orally. I had developed a hernia or found a hernia that was pre-existing in my pelvic area, and I had had a cyst before, so... And I want to see if it's developed anymore or shrinking or growing.
Sure.
So I want to go ahead and do the contrast. I'm just leery about it. I've tried to stay away from contrast altogether.
Yeah. No, they're apples and oranges. They're completely different. So you can use barium. I've never heard of anyone having like a rash from barium. I have heard people complain that it messed up their microbiome, made them constipated, maybe afterwards they have signs of bloating. I think that's analogous to like an algal bloom in a pond. You're out there in Indiana, so I'm sure you've seen duckweed and these various things. If there's a pond on a farm and they're using fertilizer, the phosphorus gets into the pond and the whole darn thing turns green. So you can put, there's some things probably that are that like barium, and it's a nutrient for them, so you get a big bloom of them after it. I only see that rarely, and it usually responds to some simple things like oregano oil and a dietary shift, to more of a vegetable, become a vegan for a week is what I tell people, and that'll knock out most bad things that have happened to you.
Okay, good.
And, lots of fiber, probably after the study, the next day you want to start doing extra fiber, extra fluid. You'll know the stuff's out when your poop
just
turns, your poop will look white initially, and it's kind of creepy, but, it's a ghost poop. So, any other questions?
No, well, I'll think of hundreds of them when I get off the phone with you, but I'll have to write them down, save them for next week.
Either that or send by email to askdrdawn.com. You just go on the website and there's a little box you can fill in questions. And thank you so much for listening all the way out there in Indiana.
I can't wait to be able to download your shows.
All right, awesome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to take this last email from Diane in Honolulu, because I feel like this is a really substantial one. My daughter, 29 years old, has been ill since she was 15. She has chronic joint pain, nausea and vomiting, and daily headaches. At 22, she was diagnosed with Addison's disease. This is a disease where your body isn't able to make cortisol. We were helpful, but the replacement of corticosteroids has not improved her health. A tilt table study determined that she has POTS. This is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And we recently realized that she clearly has dysautonomia, which is a messed up autonomic nervous system for the lay people in the audience. She has gastroparesis, which means that her stomach doesn't work properly, doesn't empty, and the guts don't have appropriate peristalsis, so she doesn't move things along. You don't get those nice ring-like contractions. She's had major weight loss. Just moving her head or standing brings on nausea and headache. From doing lots of research, it appears that her sympathetic nervous system is continually revved up and the parasympathetic isn't kicking in. While listening to one of your podcasts, I heard you mention magnesium glycinate, so I'm hoping she can try that, although swallowing is sometimes difficult. We've not been able to find a physician in Honolulu who's familiar with dysautonomia or is willing to treat her. Do I have any suggestions? I have several for you. First of all, their magnesium glycinate is available in a liquid form that's quite palatable. It's made by a company called Pure Encapsulations, and I'm sure you can order that and have it shipped to you. And yes, magnesium glycinate is good for calming. Meditation, I would be going with biofeedback, some kind of biofeedback. There's some devices that hook into a cell phone. One company that makes one is called HeartMath. And anything we can do to go from a top down, use the central nervous system to calm the autonomic nervous system, is going to be useful for your daughter. Other things that I think will be very important is to look into using a beta blocker. Beta blocker is a drug often used for hypertension. It blocks the beta receptors for epinephrine. It makes the heart rate not speed up, and it is one of the fundamental treatments for POTS. And you start with low doses. Any primary care doctor there in Hawaii will be able to prescribe it, and they can look up the doses online. But in a 29-year-old, you'd probably start, unless she's quite large, and I mean tall and muscled. I don't mean heavy, because people who are heavy don't need more beta blocker. But if you're a linebacker, you might. So those are important. Doses, 20 milligrams, 3 times a day. Maybe go to 43 times a day, but you want to start low and go up slowly. It can be quite helpful for stabilizing this disease, however. I also want to recommend a book that has some exercises in it that would be worth trying. It's written by a guy who's actually a rolfer, but he studied with this fellow named Porges, who invented something called the polyvagal theory. And the reason I'm recommending Rosenstein's book, which is called Unlocking the Healing Power of the Vagus Nerve, is number one, I just read it in my Woman Healers book group, and I asked some of the other people who had read it before, do you find the exercise helpful? And they're like, yes, these work. And these are exercises you can teach yourself. He has nice, handy pictures. He walks you through them slowly. It's definitely worth getting the book and having your daughter work the exercises, because if we can increase the ventral vagus nerve, that's going to help balance the sympathetic nervous system and get her into the right place in terms of her symptoms. So I want to wish you very good luck for that. Time for me to say good night. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.